Vivenna returned to the room. Inside, she pulled out a piece of rope, the one that Vasher had used to tie her up, the first thing that she had awakened. She'd since retrieved the breath from it. She went back outside, holding the rope between her fingers, twisting it, thinking.
The commands that Denth taught me were simple phrases. Hold things, protect me.
He'd implied that the intent was important. When she'd awakened her bonds, she'd made them move as if part of her body. It was more than just the command. The command brought the life, but the intent, the instructions from her mind, brought focus and action. She stopped beside a large tree with thin, blossom-laden branches that drooped toward the ground. She stood beside a branch, touched the bark of the tree's trunk itself to use its color. She held out the rope to the branch.
Hold things.
Vivenna felt an instant panic as her sense of the world dimmed. The rope twitched. However, instead of drawing color from the tree, the awakening pulled color from her tunic. The garment bled gray, and the rope moved, wrapping like a snake around the branch. However, the other end of the rope twisted in an odd pattern, writhing. Vivenna watched, frowning, until she figured out what was happening. The rope was twisting around her hand, trying to hold it as well.
Stop!
Nothing happened. It continued to pull tight.
Your breath to mine!
The rope stopped twisting, and her breath returned. She shook the rope free.
All right. Hold things works, but it's not very specific. It will wrap around my fingers as well as the thing I want to tie up. What if I tried something else?
Hold that branch.
Again, breath left her. More of it this time. Her trousers drained of color, and the rope end twisted, wrapping around the branch. The rest of it remained still.
So, the more complicated the command, the more breath it requires.
Your breath to mine.
Vivenna eyed her clothes, which were now completely gray. Out of curiosity, she tried awakening the rope again.
Hold that branch.
Nothing happened. She picked up a stick.
Hold that branch.
It worked this time, the stick losing its color, though it took a lot more breath. Perhaps this was because the stick wasn't very colorful. The tree trunk didn't work for color, though. Presumably, one couldn't draw color from something that was itself alive.
Your breath to mine.
Vivenna discarded the branch and fetched a few of Vasha's colored handkerchiefs from the room. She walked back to the tree.
Know what?
Could she put the breath into the rope now, then command it to hold something later? How would she even phrase that?
Hold things that I tell you to hold. Hold that branch when I tell you. Hold whatever I say.
Tell it to hold when thrown.
Vasha stood behind her. Nightblood held before him, point down. He had his pack over his shoulder. Vivenna flushed, glancing back at the rope.
Hold when thrown.
The breath left her, but the rope remained limp. So she tossed it to the side, hitting one of the hanging tree branches. The rope immediately twisted about, locking the branches together and holding them tightly.
That's useful.
Perhaps. Dangerous, though.
Why?
Get the rope back.
Vivenna paused, realizing that the rope had twisted around branches that were too high for her to reach. She hopped up, trying to grab it.
I prefer to use a longer rope.
Vasha raised Nightblood by the blade and used its hooked crossguard to pull the branches down.
If you always keep hold of one end, then you don't have to worry about it getting taken from you. Plus, you can awaken when you need to, rather than leaving a bunch of breath locked into a rope that you may or may not need.
Vivenna nodded.
Your breath to mine.
Come on. You've obviously made enough of a spectacle for one day.
Vivenna noticed that several people on the street had stopped to watch her.
How did they notice? I wasn't that obvious about what I was doing.
Huh, and how many people in Taitalir walk around in gray clothing?
Vivenna blushed as she followed Vasher into the cramped room. He set down his pack and then leaned Nightblood against one wall. Vivenna eyed the sword. She still wasn't certain what to make of the weapon. She felt a little nauseated every time she looked at it, and the memory of how violently sick she'd felt when touching it was still fresh. Plus, there had been that voice in her head. Had she really heard it? Fosher had been characteristically tight-lipped when she'd asked about it, rebuffing her questions.
Aren't you an Edrian?
Last I checked.
You seem oddly fascinated with awakening for a follower of Austri.
Fosher spoke with his eyes closed as he rested his head against the door.
I'm not a very good Edrian. Not anymore. I might as well learn to use what I have.
Good enough. I've never really understood why Austrism suddenly turned its back on awakening.
Suddenly?
Wasn't like that before the Many War.
Really?
Of course. Anyway, did you eat all of that squid?
Is that what that was?
Yes.
Fosher opened his pack, getting out another dried chunk of meat. He held it up.
Want more?
No, thank you.
What? Did I give you a bad piece?
Vivenna shook her head.
What?
It's nothing. I just don't care for fish very much.
You don't? I've been feeding it to you for 5 days now.
Vivenna nodded silently.
You ate it every time.
I'm dependent upon you for food. I don't intend to complain about what you gave me.
Fosher frowned. He still wore his torn, almost ragged clothing, but Vivenna had now been around him enough to know that he kept it clean. He obviously had the resources to get new clothing, yet he chose to wear the worn and tattered things instead. He also wore the same half-scrub, half-beard on his face. It never seemed to get longer, yet she never saw him trim it or shave it. How did he manage to keep it just the right length? Was that intentional? Or was she reading too much into it?
You aren't what I expected.
I would have been a few weeks ago.
I doubt it. That tenacious spirit you've got doesn't come from a few weeks on the streets. Neither does that sense of martyrdom.
I want you to teach me more about awakening.
What do you want to know?
I don't even know how to answer that. Denth taught me a few commands, but that was the same day that you took me captive.
Vosher nodded. They sat silent for a few minutes.
Well, are you going to say anything?
I'm thinking.
Vivenna raised an eyebrow.
Awakening is something I've done for a very, very long time. I always have trouble trying to explain it. Don't rush me.
It's okay. Take your time.
Don't patronize me either.
I'm not patronizing. I'm being polite.
Well, next time, be polite with less condescension in your voice.
Condescension? I wasn't condescending.
All right. I guess this is for the best. I'm getting tired of you walking around with that bright aura of yours that you can't even use.
Well?
Well, I think we should start with theory. There are four kinds of biochromatic entities. The first, and most spectacular, are the Returned. They're called gods here in Halundrin, but I'd rather call them spontaneous, sentient, biochromatic manifestations in a deceased host. What is odd about them is that they're the only naturally occurring biochromatic entity, which is, theoretically, the explanation for why they can't use or bestow their biochromatic investiture. Of course, the fact is that every living being is born with a certain biochromatic investiture. This could also explain why Type 1s retain sentience.
Vivenna blinked. That wasn't what she had been expecting.
You're more interested in Type 2 and Type 3 entities. Type 2 being mindless manifestations in a deceased host. They are cheap to make, even with awkward commands. This is per the law of biochromatic parallelism. The closer a host is to a living shape and form, the easier it is to awaken. Biochroma is the power of life, and so it seeks patterns of life. That, however, leads us to another law, the law of comparability. It states that the amount of breath required to awaken something isn't necessarily indicative of its power once awakened. A piece of cloth cut into a square and a piece of cloth cut into a shape of a person will take very different amounts of breath to awaken, but will be essentially the same once they have been invested. The explanation for this is simple. Some people think of awakening as pouring water into a cup. You pour until the cup is filled, and then the object comes to life. This is a false analogy. Instead, think of awakening as beating down a door. You pound and pound, and some doors are easier to open than others. But once they're open, they do about the same thing. Understand?
It's a little dense.
Well, do you want to learn or not?
You asked me if I understood, and I answered.
Type 2 biochromatic entities are what people in Halandrin call lifeless. They are different from Type 1 entities in several ways. Lifeless can be created at will and require only a few breaths to awaken, anywhere between one and hundreds, depending on the commands used. And they feed off their own color when being invested. They don't present an aura when awakened, but the breath sustains them, keeping them from needing to eat. They can die and need a special alcohol solution to remain functional past a few years of awakened status. Because of their organic host, their breath clings to the body and cannot be withdrawn once invested.
I know a little about them. Denth and his team have a lifeless.
Yes, I know. They need a command to awaken them just like anything else. Even your religion teaches about commands. It says that Austri is the one who commands the returned to come back.
Bavenna nodded.
Understanding the theory of commands is tough. Look at lifeless, for instance. It's taken us centuries to discover the most efficient ways to bring a body to a lifeless state. Even now, we're not sure if we understand how it works. I guess this is the first thing I'd like to get across to you, that biochroma is complicated. And we really don't understand most of it.
What do you mean?
Just what I've said. We don't really know what we're doing.
But you sound so technical and precise in your descriptions.
We've figured out some things, but awakeners really haven't been around all that long. The more you learn about biochroma, the more you realize that there are more things that we don't know than there are things that we do. Why are the specific commands so important? And why do they have to be spoken in your native language? What brings Type 1 entities, returned, back to life in the first place? Why are lifeless so dull-minded, while returned fully sentient? Creating Type 3 biochromatic entities is what we traditionally call awakening. That's when you create a biochromatic manifestation in an organic host that is far removed from having been alive. Cloth works the best, though sticks, reeds, and other plant matter can be used.
What about bones?
They're strange. Take far more breath to awaken than a body held together with flesh, and aren't as flexible as something like cloth. Still, breath will stick to them fairly easily, since they were once alive and maintain the form of a living thing.
So, Adrian's stories that talk about skeletal armies aren't just fabrications.
Oh, they are. If you wanted to awaken a skeleton, you'd have to arrange the bones together in their correct places. That's a lot of work for something that will take upwards of 50 or 100 breaths to awaken. Intact corpses make far more sense economically, even if the breath sticks to them so well that it becomes impossible to recover. Still, I've seen some very interesting things done with skeletons which have been awakened. Anyway, Type 3 entities, regular awakened objects, are different. Biochroma doesn't stick to them very well at all. The result is that they require quite a bit of investiture. Often well over 100 breaths to awaken them. The benefit of this, of course, is that the breath can be drawn back out again. This has allowed for quite a bit more experimentation, and that has resulted in a more comprehensive understanding of awakening techniques.
You mean the commands?
Right. As you've seen, most basic commands work easily. If the command is something the object could do, and you state it in a simple way, the command will usually work.
I tried some simple commands on the rope. They didn't work.
Those may have sounded simple, but they weren't. Simple commands are only two words long. Grab something, hold something, move up, move down, twist around. Even some two-word commands can be more complicated. And it takes practice visualizing, or, well, imagining. Well, using your mind to...
I understand that part. Like flexing a muscle.
Right. The command... Protect me, though only two words, is extremely complicated. So are others, like fetch something. You have to give the right impulse to the object. This area is where you really begin to understand how little we know. There are probably thousands of commands we don't know. The more words you add, the more complicated the mental component becomes, which is why discovering a new command can take years of study.
Like the discovery of a new command to make lifeless. 300 years ago, those who had the one-breath command could make their lifeless much more cheaply than those who didn't. That disparity started the mini-war.
Yes, or at least that was part of what caused the war. It's not really important. The thing to understand is that we're still children when it comes to awakening. It doesn't help that a lot of people who learn new, valuable commands never share them, and probably die with the knowledge.
Vivenna glanced to the side to where Nightblood sat leaning against the wall. Perhaps it was the discussion of the technical aspects of biochroma, or perhaps it was simply her growing suspicion. She was beginning to understand what wasn't right about the sword.
What is a Type 4 biochromatic entity?
Vasha fell silent.
Type 1 is a human body with sentience. Type 2 is a human body without sentience. Type 3 is an awakened object like a rope, an object with no sentience. Is there a way to create an awakened object with sentience? Like a returned, but inside of something other than a human body.
We've covered enough for one day.
You didn't answer my question.
And I'm not going to. And I advise you never to ask it again. Understand?
All right.
Vasha reached into his large pack, yanking something out.
Here, I brought you something.
Vivenna stood, walking over to pull the cloth off. Inside was a thin, well-polished dueling blade.
I don't know how to use one of these.
Then learn. If you know how to fight, you'll be far less annoying to have around. I won't have to keep pulling you out of trouble all the time.
One time.
It'll happen again.
Vivenna hesitantly picked up the sheathed sword, surprised at how light it was.
Let's go. I've got another group for us to visit.
Lightsong tried not to think about his dreams. He tried not to think about Te Talir in flames, of people dying, of the world essentially ending. He stood on the second story of his palace, looking over the court of the gods. The second story was essentially a covered roof, open on all sides. Wind blew through his hair. The sun was close to setting. Already torches were arrayed on the lawn. It was so perfect. The palaces set in a circle, lit by torches and lanterns matching the colors of the nearest building. Some of the places were dark, the buildings that currently held no guards.
What would happen if too many others returned before we killed ourselves? Would they build more palaces?
As far as he knew, there had always been enough space. At the head of the court sat the God King's palace, tall and black. It had obviously been built so that it would dominate even the extravagant mansions of the others, and it threw a wide, warped shadow across the black wall. Perfect. So perfect. The torches were arranged in patterns he could only see by standing high atop a building. The grass was kept manicured, and the massive wall tapestries were replaced often so that they showed no wear, stains, or fading. The people put forth such effort for their gods. Why? Sometimes it baffled him. But what to think of other faiths? Ones with no visible gods, only incorporeal images or wishes. Surely those gods did even less for the people than the Halandrin court, yet they still were worshipped. Lightsong shook his head. Meeting with All-Mother had reminded him of the days he hadn't thought of in a long time. Calmseer. She had been his mentor when he'd first returned. Blushweaver was jealous of his memories of her, but she didn't understand the truth. Nor could he really explain it. Kamsir had come closer to being a divinity than any returned Lightsong had known. She'd cared for her followers much as All-Mother now tried to do, but there had been genuine concern in Kamsir's regard. She hadn't helped the people because she feared that they would stop worshipping, and she had no arrogance of presumed superiority. Real kindness. Real love, real mercy. Yet even Kamsir had felt inadequate. She had often said she felt guilty because she couldn't live up to what people expected. How could she? How could anyone? In the end, he suggested this was what drove her to answer a petition. There had only been one way, in her estimation, to be the goddess everyone demanded she be, and that was to give up her life.
They push us into it. They craft all of this splendor and luxury. They give us whatever we desire. And then they subtly poke at us. Be a god. Prophesize. Maintain our illusion for us. Die. Die so that we can keep believing.
Lightsong usually stayed off his roof. He preferred to be down below where the limited perspective made it so much easier to ignore the larger view. So much easier to focus on simple things. Like his life in the moment.
Your Grace. Are you all right, Your Grace?
No man should be this important.
Your Grace?
It does strange things to you. We weren't built for it.
You're a god, Your Grace. You were built for it.
No, I'm no god.
Excuse me, but you don't really get to choose. We worship you, and that makes you our god.
You're not helping.
I apologize, Your Grace, but perhaps you should stop arguing about the same old things.
This is something different today. I'm not sure what to do.
You mean about All Mother's commands?
Lightsong nodded.
I thought I had it figured out, Scoot. I can't keep up with all the things Blushweaver is plotting. I've never been good at details. I was going to give it up. All Mother was doing a fantastic job of standing up for herself. I figured that if I gave her my commands, then she'd know what to do. She'd understand if it's better to support Blushweaver or oppose her.
You could still just let her. You gave her your commands too.
I know. So it comes down to this. The first of us who changes those commands takes control of all 20,000. The other will be locked out.
What did he choose? Did he sit back and let history happen? Or did he jump in and make a mess of it?
Whoever you are, whatever is out there that sent me back, why couldn't you just let me be? I'd already lived one life. I'd already made my choices. Why did you have to send me back?
Lightsong had tried everything, and yet people still looked to him. He knew for a fact that he was one of the most popular returned, visited by more petitioners and given more art than almost anyone else.
Honestly, what is wrong with these people?
Were they so in need of something to worship that they chose him rather than worry that their religion might be false? All-Mother claimed that some did think that. She worried about the perceived lack of faith among the common people. Lightsong wasn't certain he agreed with her. He knew of the theories that the gods who lived the longest were the weak ones because the system encouraged the best to sacrifice themselves quickly. However, the same number of petitioners came to him now as when he first started. Plus, too few gods were chosen on a whole for that to be statistically valid. Or was he just distracting himself with irrelevant details? He leaned on the railing, looking out over the green and its glowing pavilions. This could be the crowning moment for him. He could finally prove himself to be an indolent wastrel. It was perfect. If he did nothing, then All-Mother would be forced to take up the armies and resist Blushweaver. Was that what he wanted? All-Mother kept herself isolated from the other gods. She didn't attend many court assemblies and didn't listen to the debates. Blushweaver was intimately involved. She knew every god and goddess well. She understood the issues, and she was very clever. Of all of the gods, only she had begun taking steps to secure their armies.
Ciri is no threat.
But if someone else were manipulating her, would All-Mother have the political savvy to understand the danger? Without his concerned guidance, would Blushweaver see that Ciri wasn't crushed? If he did walk away, there would be a cost. He would be to blame, for he'd given up.
Who was she, Larimar? The young woman in my dreams. Was she my wife? I need to know. This time I really need to know.
No. She was not your wife.
My lover.
Larimar shook his head.
But she was important to me.
Very.
And is she still alive?
Larimar wavered, then finally nodded his head.
Still alive.
If this city fell, then she would be in danger. Everyone who worshipped Lightsong, everyone who counted on him despite his best efforts, would be in danger. Taetalir couldn't fall. Even if there were a war, the fighting wouldn't come here. Alandrin was not in danger. It was the most powerful kingdom in the world. And what of his dreams? He had been given only one real duty in the government, that of taking command of 10,000 lifeless, of deciding when they should be used and when they should not be.
Still alive.
He turned and walked toward the steps. The lifeless enclave was technically part of the Court of Gods. The huge building was built at the base of the court plateau, and a long covered walkway ran down to it. Lightsong moved down the steps with his entourage. They passed several guard posts, though he wasn't sure why they needed guards in a hallway leading from the court. A couple of guards opened the doors into the compound. It was gigantic, of course. It contained space for 40,000 lifeless. There were four large warehouses, like storage areas for the different groups of lifeless. A track for them to run around, a room filled with various stones and blocks of metal for them to lift to keep their muscles strong, and a medical area where their ichor alcohol was tested and refreshed. They passed through several twisting passages, designed to confuse invaders who might try to strike at the lifeless, then approached a guard post set beside a large open doorway. Lifesong passed the living human guards and looked in at the lifeless. He'd forgotten that they kept them in the dark. Larimar waved for a couple of priests to hold up lamps. The door opened onto a viewing platform. The floor of the warehouse extended below, filled with line upon line of silent, waiting soldiers. They wore their armor and carried their weapons in sheaths.
There are holes in the ranks.
Some of them will be exercising. I have sent a servant to fetch them.
Lightsong nodded. The lifeless stood with eyes open. They didn't shuffle or cough. Staring out over them, Lightsong suddenly remembered why he never felt any desire to return and inspect his troops. They were simply too unnerving.
Everyone out!
Your Grace, don't you want a few priests to stay?
No. I will bear this phrase myself.
Larimar hesitated, but then nodded, doing as ordered. In Lightsong's opinion, there was no good way of keeping command phrases. Leaving them in the hands of a single god was to risk losing the phrase through assassination. However, the more people who knew the command phrases, the more likely it was that the secret would be bribed or tortured out of someone. The only mitigating factor was the God King. Apparently, with his powerful biochroma, he could break lifeless more quickly. Still, taking control of 10,000 would require weeks, even for the God King. The choice was left to the individual returned. They could let some of their priests hear the command phrase so that if something happened to the god, the priests could pass the phrase on to the next returned. If the god chose not to give the phrase to his priests, then he placed an even larger burden on himself. Lightsong had found that option silly years before and had included Larimar and several others in the secret. This time, he saw wisdom in keeping the phrase to himself. Should he get the chance, he would whisper it to the God King, but only him.
Bottom line blue. I give you a new command phrase.
Lightsong paused.
Red Panther. Red Panther, step to the right side of the room.
A group of the lifeless near the front, those who could hear his voice, moved over to the side. A part of him had hoped that Allmother had come here first, that she had already changed the command phrase. But she hadn't. He opened his eyes, then took the steps down to the warehouse floor.
Bottom line blue. I give you a new command phrase. Red Panther. Bottom line blue. I give you a new command phrase.
He changed the phrase for another group. He could do about 20 or 30 at a time. He remembered the process taking hours the last time. He continued. He would leave the lifeless with their basic instructions to obey the servants when they asked the creatures to exercise or go to the infirmary. He'd give them a lesser command that could be used to move them about and make them march to specific locations, as when they had been placed in ranks outside the city to greet Ciri, and another to make them go with members of the city watch to provide extra muscle. Yet, there would only be one person with ultimate command of them. One person who could make them go to war. When he was done in this room, he would move on, taking utter command of Allmother's 10,000 as well. He would draw both armies to him, and in doing so, he would take his place at the very heart of the fate of two kingdoms. Susebron didn't leave in the mornings anymore. Ciri lay in the bed beside him, curled slightly, her skin against his skin. He slept peacefully, the white bedsheets throwing out prismatic colors around him as they inevitably reacted to his presence. A few months back, Who could have understood where she'd find herself, not only married to the god King of Halandrin, but in love with him as well? She still thought it amazing. He was the most important religious and secular figure in the whole of the Inner Sea area. He was the basis for worship of the Halandrin iridescent tones. He was a creature feared and hated by most people in Idris. And he was dozing quietly at her side. A god of color and beauty. His body is perfectly sculpted as a statue. And what was Ciri? Not perfect, of that she was sure. And yet, somehow, she'd brought to him something that he needed. A hint of spontaneity. A breath from the outside, untamed by his priests or his reputation. There would be a price to be paid for their enjoyment these last few nights.
We really are fools. We only have to avoid one thing. Giving the priest a child, or aiming ourselves straight towards disaster.
Ciri found it hard to berate herself too firmly. She suspected that her act wouldn't have fooled the priests for much longer. They would grow suspicious, or at least frustrated if she continued it without producing an heir. She could imagine them interfering if faced with more stalling. Whatever she and Suzebron did to change events, they would have to do it quickly. Ciri turned, looking at Suzebron's face as he opened his eyes. He regarded her for a few minutes, stroking her hair. It was amazing how quickly they had become comfortable in their intimacy. He reached for his writing board.
I love you.
Ciri smiled. It was always the first thing he wrote in the mornings.
And I love you. However, we are probably in trouble, aren't we? Yes. How long until it's obvious that you will bear a child? I'm not sure. I don't have much experience with this, obviously. I know that some of the women back in Idris complained of not being able to have children as quickly as they wanted, so maybe it doesn't always happen immediately. I know other women who bore children almost exactly 9 months after their wedding night.
Suzebron looked thoughtful.
A year from now, I could be a mother.
Ciri found the concept daunting. Up until a short time ago, she hadn't really thought of herself as an adult.
Of course, according to what I've been told, any children I bear the God King would be stillborn anyway.
Even if that was a lie, her child would be in danger. She still suspected that the priests would spirit it away, then replace it with a returned. In all likelihood, Ciri would then be made to disappear as well.
Bluefingers tried to warn me. He spoke of danger, not only to Suzebron, but to me. I've made a decision.
Ciri raised an eyebrow.
I want to try making myself known to the people and the other gods. I want to take control of my kingdom for myself. I thought we decided that would be too dangerous. It will be, but I'm beginning to think that it is a risk we must take. And your objections from before? You can't shout out the truth, and your guards are likely to rush you away if you try something like escaping. Yes, but you have far fewer guards, and you can yell. Yes, but would anyone believe me? What would they think if I just started screaming about how the God King is being held prisoner by his own priests?
Suzebron cocked his head.
Trust me, they'd think I was crazy. What if you gained the confidence of the returned you often speak about? Lightsong the Bold. You could go to him, tell him the truth. Perhaps he will lead you to other returned he thinks might listen. The priests will not be able to silence us all. It sounds possible, Seb, but why not just run? My serving women are from Pancol now. Bluefingers has said that he will try to get us out if I ask. We can flee to Idris. If we flee, Halandrin troops will follow, Ciri. We would not be safe in Idris. We could go somewhere else then.
Mm-mm.
Ciri, I have been listening to the arguments in the Court of Judgment.
there will soon be a war between our kingdoms. If we run, we will be abandoning Idris to invasion. The invasion will happen if we stay, too. Not if I take control of my throne. The people of Halandrin, even the gods, are obligated to obey me. There will be no war if they know I disapprove. I have told the priests that I don't want to go to war, and they appear sympathetic. However, they have done nothing. They're probably worried. If they let you start making policy, then you may begin to think you don't need them. They'd be right. I need to become the leader of my people, Ciri. That is the only way to protect your beautiful hills and the family you love so much.
Ciri fell silent, offering no further objections. To do as he was saying would be to play their hand, make a gamble for everything. If they failed, the priests would undoubtedly figure out that Ciri and Suzebron were in communication. That would spell the end of their time alone together.
It is dangerous, but it is the best option. Fleeing would be just as risky, and it would leave us in far worse circumstances. In Idris, we would be seen as the reason the Halandrin armies had come. Other countries would be even more dangerous.
Ciri slowly nodded. In another country, they'd have no money and would make perfect subjects for ransom. They'd escape the priests only to find themselves being held captive to be used against Halandrin. The King of Iridescence was still widely disliked because of the many war.
We'd be taken captive, as you say. Plus, if we were in another country, I doubt we'd be able to get you a breath every week. Without them, you'd die.
Suzebron looked hesitant.
What? I would not die without breath. But that is not an argument in favor of flight. You mean the stories of return needing breath to live are lies? Not at all. We do need breath, but you forget that I hold the wealth of breath passed down from generations in my family. I heard my priest speak of this once. If it were necessary to move me, I could survive on the extra breaths I hold, those over and above the breath that makes me returned. My body would simply feed off those extra breaths, absorbing one a week.
Ciri sat back thoughtfully. That seemed to imply something about breath that she couldn't quite figure out. Unfortunately, she just didn't have the experience to sort through it.
Oh, right. So we could go into hiding if we needed to. I said this was not an argument for fleeing. My treasure of breaths might keep me alive, but it would also make me a very valuable target. Everyone will want those breaths. Even if I weren't the God King, I would be in danger. All right. If we're really going to try to expose what the priests have done, I think we make our move soon. If I display any signs of being pregnant, I bet it will take the priests all of 2 heartbeats to sequester me. There will be a general assembly of the court in a couple of days. I have heard my priests say that this will be an important meeting. It is rare that the gods are all called together to vote. That meeting will decide whether or not we march on Idris. I could sit with Lightsong and plead for his help. If we go to several of the other gods, perhaps they, in front of the crowds, can demand to know whether or not I am lying. And I will open my mouth and reveal that I have no tongue. Then let us see what the priests do. They will be forced to bow to the will of their own pantheon. All right, let's try it.
Vasher found her practicing again. He hovered outside the window, lowered down from the roof via an awakened rope which gripped him about the waist. Inside, the Venner repeatedly awakened a strip of cloth, unaware of Vasher.
Wiggle across the room, wrap around that cup, then bring it back without spilling.
She's learning so quickly.
The commands themselves were simple to say, but providing the right mental impulse was difficult. It was like learning to control a second body. Ravenna was quick. Yes, she had a lot of breath. That made it easier. But true instinctive awakening, the ability to awaken objects without training or practice, was a gift granted only by the sixth heightening. That was one step beyond even what Returned had with their single deific breath. Ravenna was far from that stage. She learned faster than she should have, even if he knew she were frustrated by how often she got things wrong. Even as he watched, she made a mistake. The cloth wiggled across the room, but climbed into the cup instead of wrapping around it. It shook, making the cup fall over. Then the rope finally returned, leaving a soggy trail.
Your breath to mine.
Colors!
Ravenna walked over to refill the cup. She never noticed Vasha hanging just outside. He wasn't surprised. He was currently a drab, his excess breath stored in his shirt. Ravenna replaced the cup, and he pulled himself up as she walked back. Of course, the mechanics of how he moved about with the ropes were far more complicated than they seemed. His command incorporated making the rope respond to taps of his finger along its length. Awakening was different from creating a lifeless. Lifeless had brains and could interpret commands and requests. The rope had none of that. It could only act on its original instructions. With a few taps, he lowered himself again. Ravenna faced away from him as she picked up another colored swatch to use as fuel when she awakened her cup-fetching ribbon.
I like her. I'm glad we didn't kill her.
Vasha didn't respond.
She's very pretty, don't you think?
You can't tell.
I can't tell! I've decided that I can.
Vasha shook his head. Pretty or not, the woman should never have come to Halandrin. She'd given Denth the perfect tool.
Of course. Denth probably didn't need that tool.
Halandrin and Idris were close to snapping. Vasha had stayed away too long. He knew that. He also knew that there was no way he would have come back earlier.
Wiggle across the room. Wrap around that cup, then bring it back without spilling.
Inside the room, Ravenna successfully managed to get the cloth to bring her the cup, and she drank from it with a satisfied look that Vasha could just barely see from the side. He had the rope lower him to the ground.
Your breath to mine.
Vasha climbed the external steps to the room. Ravenna turned as Vasha entered. She set down the cup, hurriedly stuffing the cloth in her pocket.
What does it matter if he sees me practicing? It's not like I have anything to hide.
But practicing before him was embarrassing. He was so stern, so unforgiving of faults. She didn't like him to see her fail.
Well?
Both the house you are using and the safe house in the slums are empty. Denth is too clever to get caught like that. He must have figured that you would reveal his location.
Ravenna ground her teeth in frustration, settling back against the wall.
I was hoping we'd be able to watch him. Maybe get a jump on what he's planning next.
Didn't work. No use crying about it. Come on, I think I can get us in to meet with some of the Idrian workers at one of the orchards, assuming we arrive during the lunch break.
Vasher, we can't keep doing this.
This?
When I was with Denth, we met with crime lords and politicians. You and I are meeting with peasants on corners and in fields.
They're good people.
I know they are. But do you really think we're making a difference? Compared to what Denth is doing, I mean.
I know. I've tried other leads. But the truth is that most everything I do seems a step behind Denth. I can kill his gangs of thieves, but he has more of them than I can find. I've tried to figure out who is behind the war, even followed leads in the Court of Gods itself, but everyone is growing more and more tight-lipped. They assume the war to be inevitable now, and don't want to be seen as being on the losing side of the argument.
What about priests? Aren't they the ones who bring things to the attention of the gods? If we can get more of them to argue against the war, then maybe we can stop it.
Priests are fickle. Most of those who argued against the war have caved in. Even Nanrova switched sides on me.
Nanrova?
High Priest of Stillmark. I thought he was solid. He even met with me a few times to talk about his opposition of the war. Now he refuses to see me anymore and has switched sides. Colorless liar.
Nanrova? Vasher, we did something to him.
What?
We helped a gang of thieves rob from a salt peddler.
We used a couple of distractions to cover the burglary. We set a fire in a nearby building and overturned a carriage that was passing through the garden. The carriage belonged to a high priest. I think his name was Nunrova.
Callous.
You think it might be connected?
Maybe. You know which thieves were actually doing the robbery?
Ravenna shook her head.
I'll be back. Wait here.
So she did. Ravenna waited for hours. She tried practicing her awakening, but she'd already spent most of the day working on that. She was mentally exhausted and found it difficult to concentrate. Eventually, she found herself staring out the window in annoyance. Denth had always let her go on his information-gathering forays.
That was just because he wanted to keep me close.
Now that she looked back, there were obviously lots of things Denth had been hiding from her. Vasher just didn't care to placate her. He wasn't stingy with information, though, when she asked. His answers were grumpy, but he did usually answer. She still mulled over their conversation about awakening, less because of what he'd said, more because of the way he'd said it. She'd been wrong about him. She was almost certain of that now. She had to stop judging people. But was that possible? Wasn't interaction based in part on judgments? A person's background and attitudes influenced how she responded to them. The answer, then, wasn't to stop judging. It was to hold those judgments as mutable. She'd judged Denth to be a friend, but she shouldn't have ignored the way he talked about mercenaries having no friends.
Start reaching for that sword when you're startled. There's little reason to grab your shirt, unless you're planning to rip it off.
Ravenna's hair twinged red. The sword he had brought her lay on the side of the room. They hadn't had much opportunity to practice, and she still barely even knew how to hold the thing properly.
Well?
It was already dark outside, and the city was beginning to sparkle with lights.
The robbery was a cover. The real hit was that carriage. Denth promised the thieves something valuable if they committed a robbery and started a fire, both as distractions to get at the carriage.
Why?
I'm not sure.
Coins? When Tonkfa hit the horse, it knocked a chest off the top. It was filled with gold.
What happened then?
I left with some others. I thought the carriage itself was the distraction, and once it went down, I was supposed to pull out.
Denth?
He wasn't there, come to think of it. The others told me he was working with the thieves.
Vasher nodded, walking over to his pack. He threw aside the bedrolls, then took out several articles of clothing. He pulled off his shirt, exposing a well-muscled and rather hairy torso. Vivenna blinked in surprise, then flushed. She probably should have turned aside, but the curious part of her was too strong. What was he doing? He didn't remove his trousers, thankfully, but instead threw on a different shirt. The sleeves of this one were cut into long ribbons near the wrists.
Upon call, become my fingers and grip that which I must.
The cuff tassels wiggled.
Wait, what was that? A command?
Too complicated for you.
Vasher knelt and undid the cuff of his trousers. She could see that there, too, there were extra lengths of cloth.
Become as my legs and give them strength.
The leg tassels crossed under his feet, growing tight. Ravenna didn't argue with his insistence that the commands were too complicated. She just memorized them anyway. Finally, Vasher threw on his tattered cloak, which was ripped in places.
Protect me.
Ravenna could see a lot of his remaining breath drain into the cloak. He wrapped his rope belt around his waist. It was thin for a rope, but strong, and she knew its purpose was not to keep his trousers up. Finally, he picked up Nightblood.
You coming?
Where?
We're going to capture a few of those thieves. Ask them exactly what Denth wanted with that carriage.
Why invite me? Won't I just make it harder for you?
Depends. If we get into a fight and you get in the way, then it will be more difficult. If we get into a fight and half of them attack you instead of me, it will make things easier.
Assuming you don't offend me.
That's a good assumption. If you want to come, come. But don't expect me to protect you. And whatever you do, don't try and follow on your own.
I wouldn't do such a thing.
I thought I'd make the offer. You're no prisoner here, princess. You can do whatever you want. Just don't get in my way when you do it. Understand?
I understand. And I'm coming.
Vasher simply pointed at her sword.
Keep that on.
Ravenna nodded, tying it on.
Draw it. No, hold it like this.
Vasher corrected her grip.
What good will holding it properly do?
I still don't know how to use it.
Look threatening, and it might make someone attacking you pause. Make them hesitate for a couple of seconds in a fight, and that could mean a lot.
Vavenna nodded nervously, sliding the weapon back in its sheath. Then, she grabbed several lengths of rope.
Hold when thrown.
She stuffed the rope into her pocket. Vasher eyed her.
Better to lose the breath than get killed.
Few awakeners agree with you. To most of them, the thought of losing breath is far more frightening than the prospect of death.
Well, I'm not like most awakeners. Half of me still finds the process blasphemous.
Put the rest of your breath somewhere else. We can't afford to draw attention.
Vavenna grimaced, then did as told, putting her breath into her shirt.
My breath to yours.
Let's go.
Night in Taetalir was very different from her homeland. There, it had been possible to see so many stars overhead that it looked like a bucket of white sand had been dashed into the air. Here, there were street lamps, taverns, restaurants, and houses of entertainment. The result was a city full of lights, a little like the stars themselves had come down to inspect Grand Taetalir, and yet Vavenna was still saddened by how few real stars she saw in the sky. None of that meant that the palaces they were going to were by any means bright. Vasher led her through the streets, and he likely became little more than a hulking shadow. They left behind places with streetlights and even lit windows, moving into an unfamiliar slum. This was one of those she'd been afraid to enter, even when she lived on the streets. The night seemed to grow even darker as they entered and walked down one of the twisting dark alleys that passed for streets in such places. Eventually, Vasher pulled to a stop. He pointed toward a building, single-story, flat-topped and wide. It sat alone in a depression, shanties built from refuse covering the low hill behind it. Vasher waved for her to stay back.
My breath to give, for life to live.
He put the rest of his breath into a rope and crept forward up the hill. Vavenna waited, nervous, kneeling beside a decaying shanty that appeared to have been built from half-crumbling bricks.
Why did I come? He didn't tell me to. He simply said that I could. I could just as easily have stayed behind.
But she was tired of things happening to her. She had been the one to point out that maybe there was a connection between the priest and Dent's plan. She wanted to see this to the end. Do something. That had been easy to think back in the lit room. It didn't help her nerves that looming to the left side of the shanty was one of the Daedalir statues. There had been some of them in the Highland slums as well, though most of those had been defaced or broken. A shadow loomed over her. She nearly gasped in shock, but managed to keep it in as she recognized Nightblood in the figure's hand.
Two guards, both silenced.
Will they do for answering our questions?
No. Practically kids. We need someone important. We'll have to go in. Either that, or sit and watch for a few days to determine who is in charge, then grab him when he's alone.
That would take too long.
I agree. I can't use the sword, though. When Nightblood is done with the group, there's never anyone to question. Come on.
Vavenna followed as quietly as she could, moving for the front door. Vasher grabbed her arm and shook his head. She followed him around to the side, barely noticing the two lumps of unconscious bodies rolled into a ditch. At the back of the building, Vasher began to feel around on the ground.
Colors.
After a few moments without success, he pulled something from his pocket, a handful of straw. In just a few seconds, he had constructed three little men from the straw and some thread, then used breath, reclaimed from his cloak, to animate them.
Find tunnels.
The little men scuttled around on the ground. Vasher himself returned to his searching. One of the straw men began to jump up and down. The other two rushed over to it, and then they began to bounce as well. Vasher joined them, as did Vavenna, and she watched as he uncovered a trap door hidden beneath a thick layer of dirt. He raised it a tad, then reached underneath. His hand came back out with several small bells, which had apparently been rigged there to ring if the door were opened all the way.
No group like this has a hideout without bolt holes. Usually a couple of them. Always trapped.
Vavenna watched as he recovered the breath from the straw men.
I'm sorry. Your breath to mine.
Vavenna frowned at the curious words. They were just piles of straw. Why apologize? Vasher then led the way down through the trap door. Ravenna followed, stepping softly, skipping a particular step when Vasher indicated. The bottom was a roughly cut tunnel, or so she got from feeling along the sides of the lightless earthen chamber. Vasher moved forward. She followed, and was curious to see light ahead. Soon she could see Vasher's silhouette. She moved up next to him, peeking out of their tunnel and into an earthen room. There was a fire burning at the center, the smoke twisting up through a hole in the ceiling. The upper chamber, the building itself, was probably just a front, for the chamber down here looked very lived in. There were piles of cloth, bedrolls, pots and pans, all of it as dirty as the men who sat around the fire. Vasher gestured to the side. There was another tunnel a few feet to the side of the one they were hiding in. Vivenna's heart jumped in shock as Vasher crept into the room and toward the second tunnel. She glanced at the fire. The men were very focused on their drinking and were blinded by the light. They didn't seem to notice Vasher. Vivenna followed into the shadows of the large room, feeling exposed with the firelight to her back. Vasher didn't go far, however, before stopping. Vivenna nearly collided with him. He stood there for a few moments. Finally, Vivenna poked him in the back, trying to get him to move aside so that she could see what he was doing. He shuffled, letting her see what was before him. This tunnel ended abruptly. Apparently, it wasn't so much a tunnel as a nook. Nestled against the back of the nook was a cage, about as high as Vivenna's waist. Inside the cage was a child. Vivenna pushed past Vasher and kneeled down beside the cage.
The valuable thing in the carriage. It wasn't the coins. It was the priest's daughter. The perfect bargaining chip if you wanted to blackmail someone into changing their position at court.
As Vivenna knelt, the girl pulled back in the cage. The cage stank of human waste and the child was covered in grime, all except for lines on her cheeks, which had been streaked clean by tears. Vivenna looked up at Vasher. His eyes were shattered, his back to the fire, but she could see him gritting his teeth. She could see tension in his muscles. He turned his head to the side, half illuminating his face with the light of the red fire. In that single lit eye, Vivenna saw fury.
Hey!
Get the child out!
How did you get here?
Vasher met her eyes with his single illuminated one, and she felt herself shrink before him. She nodded, and Vasher turned away from her, one hand clenching into a fist, the other grabbing Nightblood in a hard-knuckled grip. He stepped slowly, deliberately, as he approached the men. Vivenna intended to do as asked, but she found it hard to look away from him.
That's right, then! Come on!
Nightblood, still sheathed, took one man in the chest. Another man attacked, and Vasher spun, whipping out a hand. Tassels on his sleeve moved on their own, wrapping around the blade of the thief's sword, catching it. Vasher's momentum ripped the blade free, and he tossed it aside. His hand snapped up, grabbing the thief's face. The tassels wrapped around the man's head like a squid's tentacles. Vasher slammed the man backward and down into the ground. Vasher rammed the sheathed Nightblood into the other man's legs. A third tried to cut Vasher from behind.
Vasher, behind you!
Vasher's cloak, however, suddenly whipped out, moving on its own, and grabbed the surprised man by the arms. Vasher turned, anger in his face, and swung Nightblood toward the entangled man. With shaking fingers, Vivenna tried to open the cage. It was locked, of course.
Open! Release the cage! Metal, of course. It hasn't been alive, so it can't be awakened.
Vivenna raised the thread.
Unlock things.
The thread wiggled a bit, and she stuck it into the lock. Nothing happened.
Have to get the intention right. Needed to go inside, twist the tumbler free. Twist things.
Vivenna stuck the thread into the lock. The door opened.
Your breath to mine.
Vivenna reached into the cage. The girl hid her face.
I'm a friend. Please, I'm here to help you.
Vivenna reached out to touch the girl. Frustrated, Vivenna turned back toward Vasher. He stood beside the fire, head bowed, body strewn around him. He held Nightblood in one hand, sheathed tip resting back against the dirty floor. And, for some reason, he seemed larger than he had a few moments ago. taller, broader of shoulders, more threatening. Vasha's other hand was on Nightblood's hilt. The sheath clasp was undone, and black smoke crept out off of the blade, some pouring toward the ground, some floating up toward the ceiling, as if it couldn't decide. Vasha's arm was quivering.
Draw me. Kill them.
Many of the men still twitched on the ground. Vasha began to slide the blade free. It was dark black, and it seemed to suck in the firelight.
This isn't good.
Vasha! Vasha, the girl won't come to me!
Vasha froze, then glanced at her, eyes glazed over.
You defeated them, Vasha. No need to draw the sword.
Yes. Yes, there is.
Vasha blinked, then saw her. He kicked a body as he passed.
Colorless monsters.
Vasha looked into the cage. He no longer seemed larger, and she decided that what she'd seen must have just been a trick of the light. He reached into the cage, holding out his hands, and, oddly, the child immediately went to him. Vivenna watched with shock. Vasha picked the child up, tears in his own eyes.
You know her?
I met Menrova. I knew he had young children, but I never met any of them.
Then how? Why did she come to you?
Come on. I attacked the ones who came running down when they heard screams. But more might return.
Vasha looked like he almost wished that would happen. He turned toward the exit tunnel, and Vivenna followed.